The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution.
And thank you very, very much indeed. And just looking through the calls that are coming in, they're still streaming in about the GAA. Divided, but more opposed than in favour, if you know what I mean. Now, we have been joined in studio by John Bowman because we're going to talk about the historic state visit of President Michael D. Higgins to Britain next week. John will be in Britain for the state visit as part of RT's television coverage, the big day being Tuesday. Later, his laying of a wreath at the grave of the unknown warrior, then his keynote address at both Houses of Parliament, Windsor, all of this followed by a return to Windsor Castle. Did we ever think we'd see the day, John? And the significance of it, it's different to other state visits.
Well, it's different to all the official visits, of which there have been many. It was 21 years ago that the first time that an Irish president met the Queen, and that was Mary Robinson at Buckingham Palace. That was a step. And there are incremental steps, and they're always by increments. For many, many odd reasons, all of them, I suppose, historical, and all to do with the complexity of Anglo-Irish relations, there has not been a state visit. For instance, the Queen, who's been on the throne for so long, never made a state visit to the Republic. It's one of the very few patches of the map anywhere in the world that she hadn't been. And she had great interest, of course, in horses and in so much. But it was always wanted by those who, once they could see that a state visit would mean that it would be an indication that relations were normal, settled, friendly and reciprocal.
That's debatable too, aren't they? I mean, when you think of Northern Ireland and, you know, people who are still railing against the peace process and all of that, like, it's not settled yet.
No, but hold on now. The most important date in the last 1,000 years in Ireland, I remember being asked to write a piece on the millennium, was the day that this island voted by 85% for the Good Friday Agreement.
Yes.
Now, in the geographical space that we share on this island, there never was a moment when 85%, and by the way, 14 points of the who said no were the DUP. 1% was Republican saying no. So you have 40%, and the DUP are now on board. So let's remember that we are now agreed on the political architecture of this island. Complex, bespoke, important, but let's not talk up those who disagree with it.
Well, the interesting thing is somebody was talking last night about is that if you take the miracle in a way that was the French and the Germans getting together to as founding the what has become the EU after the war they had together, like humans can do it if they decide to get it. But let's go back in history a little bit. The UK ambassador was talking about something very special about this.
Yes, well, it is very special because it's such a change from the frosty relationship which has we've had with the monarchy for so long. The crown itself was, of course, the crunch issue in the original settlement in 1921, the Lloyd George, the treaty. The crown was a key issue at that time. It divided Irish opinion, divided the treaty, supplied the treaty split, and indeed it was at the heart of the Civil War. And it didn't go away because even those Collins said this is not freedom, it is freedom to win freedom. And the freedom was to chip away at that notion of the crown. And it was finally, De Valera delivered that in 1937. Mm. But in the meantime, some indication of how much a pawn the British king was and the monarchy was in Irish politics can be gleaned from one 1928 event, the RDS Spring Horse Show.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, it's a sort of interesting anecdote, but it tells us so much about Ireland in the 20s. Lady Lavery was asked by Josephine McNeill, who was the wife of the Governor General, the King's representative in the Viceregal Lodge, now Oras an Uachtaráin, to get up a party to come to the RDS for the horse show. And she said that Hazel Lavery included in the list to choose a party of suitable English guests to stay at the Viceregal Lodge for the 1928 horse show. Lady Lavery decided to include, among others, Lord Gage, Lord-in-Waiting to King George V. As she thought it would be a good idea to bring over one or two who would subsequently give in royal circles a good impression of what Lady Lavery called Sinn Féin Ireland. Now, Clementine Churchill, writing to Winston, who she's the evidence of this, Lady Lavery was outraged when she received a long and pompous letter from Mrs. McNeill from the Viceregal Lodge, explaining that anyone, however humble and unknown, who had any connection with the King of England would not be persona grata, not, of course, on personal grounds, but for high political reasons. Lady Lavery cancelled the whole thing, told all her guests to forget it, and she went off to County Down to stay in Mountstuart.
Extraordinary stories.
Yes, and McNeill, of course, eventually was the Governor General who left because he felt slighted by the Fianna Fáil. When they came in, they wanted to get rid of the oath, get rid of all the monarchy, all the references to that. But constitutionally, they were still running the Irish Free State Constitution, and the King had this minor role in it. McNeill was affronted, and when De Valera advised George V to remove him, De Valera put in his place a Maynooth grocer, Donal O'Buchla, who didn't go to the Viceregal Lodge, ignored the office and drained it of all power.
And how would, when you talk about the relationship with the monarchy, how would that have impinged on the monarchy?
The monarchy was, well, it was being looked after, as it were, by the Dominions Office at the time, and they were very annoyed with De Valera. They were advising him to do this and that, and he was on a unilateral initiative, undoing the treaty increment by increment, and he wasn't really listening to them. And in fact, it came to a crisis for him in 1936 when the abdication crisis came up, because De Valera was obliged to do something about the abdication crisis. If he did nothing, Edward would still have been king in the Irish Free State for the minor role he was playing, and Mrs. Simpson would have been, somebody said, she'll be the Queen of Southern Ireland. So they brought in, Brilliant. Very rapidly and overnight a guillotine motion, which is the External Relations Act. That's why we have that. And then in the Constitution, which followed the following year, the President plays all that role.
It's extraordinary. When I saw Mrs. Simpson on the list, I thought, holy goodness, I didn't know that little bit, it has to be said. But very interesting. So moving on from there then, how did we sever and then come back together?
Well, we all know that the Irish neutrality during the war was a difficult issue for the British. But it was, in fact, for those who really knew all about it, and the people in the Dominions office certainly did, Churchill didn't want to know the detail. He wanted his grievance rather than. But what he got actually was the most pro-Allied policy possible. There was huge cooperation, and indeed, I've often sort of made the point that the Americans, who also were critical of Irish neutrality, De Valera's policy was the same as Roosevelt's. Neutral unless attacked, and for the same reason that Roosevelt could only bring America into the war when, after Pearl Harbor, he couldn't do it before that. Mm. Likewise, if De Valera had tried to bring Ireland into the war, it wouldn't have worked.
Right, and then the formal declaration of the Irish Republic.
Yes, that was 1948, and that was the final, as it were. Again, that's a very exotic story of Canada and John A. Costello and so on. I don't think De Valera was best pleased, because he was trying to keep this small link with the Commonwealth because of his ambitions to have some change in Northern Ireland. But it is important to notice that all of that had to be remade after we left the Commonwealth. There was a very big issue of, say, the rights of Irish professionals like doctors and engineers and architects to be able to work automatically in Canada. That all had to be rebuilt. All the trade preferences that came from our membership of the Commonwealth had to be rebuilt. It was mainly done by Evatt, the Australian Foreign Minister at the time. But it was a rather clumsy manner in which it was not negotiated. It was just announced in Canada by John A. Costello.
How was it received?
It was received very badly, and in fact, there was a great negative really in the Government of Ireland Act, because what happened in the Government of Ireland Act, which came in on the British side in 1949, was that although Irish unity was always denied in the name that the Ulster Unionists wouldn't tolerate it, the custody of that veto was handed over to Stormont. It was handed over to the Unionists. It used to be in London, but in the Ireland Act, it actually went to London. So that was quite a decline in Dublin's leverage in 1948-49.
Interesting, and it took so long to get it back. Mm. So long. Anyway, let's look forward a little as well. Looking back on the visit of the Queen to Ireland and the kind of tension and the empty streets in Dublin and the visit to the Garden of Remembrance and the slow development of things and people eventually coming around to this tremendous support for the whole thing. It will be quite different, I would think, for President Higgins when he's in across the water.
Well, of course it will, because the security dimension is nothing like it was. In fact, it must have been absolutely extraordinary. I doubt if the Queen ever had any journey quite like the journey from the Garden of Remembrance down to Trinity College, past the GPO and so on. Empty streets, no motor cars allowed, nothing parked. It's just a most extraordinary streetscape,
like a ghost.
For reasons that we all know. I remember I was doing the commentary on that at the time, in both places, and it really was absolutely extraordinary. But it all came together, it all worked out, it was very popularly received by the television audience and so on. And finally, in Cork, it loosened out just in the last hours of her visit, and it all worked out extremely well. And indeed, Buckingham Palace had a post bag, a huge post bag, unlike other visits, other royal visits. And many of them expressing...
From Irish people?
Well, a lot of it was from Irish people who were best pleased that it had happened and that it had gone so well.
Oh.
Very pleased with it.
Yeah. So what's going to happen next week? It'll be a very different type of trip.
Well, yes, but some of the same points that their choreography, of course, is important in the presidency. We've seen that particularly since Mary Robinson's, that a lot of it is to do with the visits you make and the symbolism of whom you choose to visit. And it's an absolutely extraordinary itinerary. A president will have a ceremonial welcome. We'll be going through horse and carriage with the Queen, and Prince Philip will be with Mrs. Higgins through Windsor, and a ceremonial inspection of the Guard of Honour. President Higgins goes to Westminster Abbey to lead a wreath at the grave of the unknown soldier, then to Westminster, where he makes a keynote address all on Tuesday to invited members of both Commons and the Lords, and later there's a state banquet hosted by the Queen.
What would you anticipate he might say in that speech?
Well, I think he'll be talking broadly about the interdependence of the two countries and the fact that we are with so many links. I think he's very aware of that and has made those sort of comments so often on his many visits to Britain. And then he'll be at Wednesday at the University College London Hospital to emphasise the role of the Irish in the National Health Service, the Royal Society. He'll be speaking on British-Irish cooperation in scientific developments. He'll have lunch with David Cameron at Downing Street, another banquet at the City of London. In all, he's making 8 speeches.
It's a packed itinerary, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And ending on Friday at Coventry Cathedral, and then, very important for President Higgins, at Coventry's Guildhall, where he will meet many members of the Irish community, who he will also be meeting on the music night on Thursday. There's also, by the way, a Northern Ireland-themed event, reception at Windsor Castle on the Thursday. But the emphasis on the Irish in Britain has always been very close to President Higgins' heart. When he was at school, he would have been at school with many boys who didn't get the chance in life that he got and that he's so...
Right. And he appreciates so much.
And he appreciates that. And many of them went to build... To be builders and labourers in Britain. Yeah.
Now, some of our guests have left, but Mary Hanavan is still with us and Declan Power. Do you see it as a great historic moment?
I do, yeah. I see it as a kind of a bookend to the previous the visit by Queen Elizabeth that John was referring to. And the taking us through the historical stepping stones there was quite interesting, because it... underpins, like for listeners there who might be of varying age groups, it puts things into a context, and it puts also the notion that for too long on this island there was one sense of identity that was depending on which end of the island you were in, and it was kind of rammed home. And now we've come to realise that there's a spectrum of Irish identity, and you can be at one end of it or the other end of it, or you can be in a blended area. And I was also minded to think of the excellent excerpts of broadcast that I was listening to this morning from John about that great former senator writer Sam McAuldry, great Irishman I would call him, because he kind of defined the notion that identity can be across the spectrum. I think when he made his maiden speech in the Senate, he talked about being an Irishman from a unionist background who was happy to be in the Senate in Dublin and happy to come from a part of Ireland that was under British jurisdiction. I'm paraphrasing a bit now.
Yeah.
And this visit now, it has aspects of allowing people cultural permission to the different aspects of their this joined identity. I mean, the diaspora in England, in Britain, the people who have grown up second generation. I think the singer Morrissey, didn't he write about, he had either an album or a song called Irish Blood, English Heart. So people who are born and who have English accents, born in England with English accents, who have a sense of Irish identity. Then you have people who are born in Ireland with varying kinds of accents whose sense of Irish identity might be slightly more Anglo. And I'm not just talking about the Northern Protestants in the North. I'm talking about people who come from old Anglo-Irish traditions in the South.
I think at one stage the definition of being Irish was bordering on not being English.
Exactly. And I mean, it was so negative. And it meant you could only take pride in certain things. I remember as a child being brought to see a film called A Bridge Too Far by my father. And the thing that stuck in my head was a character that was played by Michael Caine. His name was John Ormsby Matheson Vandeleur. Right, it didn't sound very Irish. He was known as Joe Vandeleur, and he commanded one of the Irish Guards battalions that led the relief column to try and get to the paratroopers. It was a leading role, and I remember kind of feeling that little bit extra taller. So the Irish actually were very involved in this particular battle, which stimulated my interest in the history of the Irish in the Second World War. And this was something that wasn't being talked about, or that we didn't have any awareness of.
Yeah.
And then what I didn't realise at that stage, I'm from Mullingar. The Vandeleurs were a family from outside Mullingar, I think around Colucan. And later, during my service in the army, discovered that the 4th Field Artillery Regiment, now defunct, sadly, in Mullingar at the time, had his tunic and other accoutrements donated by members of his family. They were in the regimental museum in Mullingar for a long time.
There you go.
So just, it's a little illustration of the joined history. And now it's been brought home, and we've cultural permission to acknowledge it and to enjoy it.
Mary
it's
Hannafin.
A long, long story, and I thought it was wonderful to hear John talk about it. But I mean, I grew up in a very Republican house where my gran talked about carrying messages in the roll of her hair, and with the Cumann na mBan medal was there. And then 90 years later, I got to meet the Queen when she came to Dublin. And it was an extraordinary sense of history. But in those incremental steps that John was talking about, I remember in government, in the post-Good Friday Agreement years, as relations were improving, every now and then the question will come up about a state visit and inviting the Queen. And particularly after the first official visit by Mary Robinson, and then the very warm relations between President Mary McAleese and the Queen, she genuinely wanted to invite the Queen over. But there were political considerations as well, because of course it had to be the government who would okay such an invitation. And remember, one of the key things was the policing in Northern Ireland, to make sure that those issues had been dealt with. But it didn't stop us kind of making the incremental steps. Like, for example, in 2006, when the government decided to commemorate the 90th anniversary of the 1916 Rising in a very big way, we also decided to send a government minister to commemorate the Battle of the Somme. And I was Minister for Education at the time, former history teacher, and I actually volunteered to go. I said, I'd really like to do this. And I went, and John remember the time that we went, and laid a wreath at the Somme site, and Prince Charles was there and did the same. But it actually meant so much to Irish people who had served in the British Army that we recognised them. And it was just one of those steps. And then a couple of years later, Prince Charles and Camilla were invited to the Irish Embassy in London. Again, a big step in the preparations for the state visit. And I happened to be at that as well. And they came in, and they were expected to spend about 45 minutes. And I think 2.5 hours later, they had met every single person in the room. And they went in two different directions, like a figure of eight. And they met members of the Irish community, people in the emigrant associations, in the cultural field, in the artistic field. A forerunner, really, of a taste of what was to come later. The only thing that struck me was, I remember in Prince Charles' speech, he actually stood up and said, that he had no idea that the Irish were so involved in so many different areas. And I'm thinking, how did you not know this for the last 100 years? But all of those steps kind of helped along the way to the tremendously successful state visit. And now to President Michael D. Higgins going, which I think is just so exciting, not just for us at home looking at it. I think it's really, really significant for Irish people living in Britain. The people who, for many years, many of them didn't even declare their Irishness. They were afraid to. People who also just worked very strongly and quietly on the ground in community organisations and immigrant associations. Now we're talking about the huge successes of the Irish. You know, we're making it big in music and culture and millinery and whatever. But the real heroes are actually those people who looked after very many downtrodden Irish. And the Irish Abroad Unit in the Department of Foreign Affairs was largely set up to help those and to help those associations. Mm. And there is a line on government spending every year that goes to help the Irish emigrant groups. And I hope there'll come a day where they won't need government assistance, but it should always be there for them. And this is a huge recognition of their work in those associations. And I know the President will tap into that. And I love the way he's going to tap into young people as well. There's going to be a meeting.
Well, that was always part of his
yes,
campaign.
Yes, which is great. And to hear those views, I think that'd be fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I hope you enjoy your time in Windsor, John.
Yes.
Looking forward to it.
Looking forward to it, yeah.
It's interesting to hear the choreography down through the years and the step and increments and so on and so forth. And let us hope that it will be a great success. And I have no doubt that it will. And thank you very much indeed. And we take a break.
1850 715 150.